Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
What is the positive case for intelligent design? I'm Keith Pinnock, producer of ID the Future, and on this episode of the ID the Future podcast, Casey Luskin finishes the second installment of his presentation on the positive case for intelligent design. As frequent listeners of the podcast will know, Casey Luskin is our program officer for public policy and legal affairs at the Center for Science and Culture. But Casey also has a master's degree in earth science from the University of California, San Diego.
What are some examples of complex and specified information and examples of design in nature? Well, I think one of the best examples is in our genetic code. Our DNA contains billions of bits of information that is ordered in the form of these nucleotide bases that are strung along the backbone of our DNA molecule. These are A, T, C, and G. If you remember back to high school biology, it's short for adenine, cytosine, thymine, and guanine. And these nucleotide bases are ordered in a very specific order in order to encode for all of the proteins and all the structures that are in your body. And every organism in the entire world is built upon this DNA code, this genetic code. And what we find is that proteins in particular, if you mutate or change key nucleotides in a protein, the protein will not function properly. So what we see is that the information in life is carefully ordered to encode the structures in our bodies. And the more we learn about DNA, the more we're finding that the vast majority of our DNA performs very important functions in our cells and encodes for important structures in our cells that are necessary for an organism to function. So the bottom line is that encoded the information in our DNA, it contains astronomical amounts of complex and specified information. And this, I think, is one of the greatest discoveries of the 20th century that testifies to intelligent design in life. And the more we learn about DNA, the more we're finding that there are actually more and more codes that we weren't even aware of. There are codes on top of codes in some cases. It's really quite incredible. So how does this information in the DNA get converted into protein, get converted into the actual structures, the matter that makes up our bodies? Well, the way that works is through an information processing system, which in many respects resembles computer information processing. So I'll give you guys an example. I don't have one with me right now, but let's say I had a CD-ROM. Maybe it has information on it. Having that CD-ROM itself is not going to do anything for me without a computer to transform and process that information into some useful form and then give you output on a computer screen, right? You have to have some way to process and compute that information in order for it to be functional. So in the same way, the information in our DNA by itself is not going to do anything unless you have a whole suite of micromolecular machines that help to process that information and convert it into proteins, into biological structures. And the way that that is done is through a system of commands and codes, which in many respects resembles computer code. As a matter of fact, there have been a lot of authorities who have recognized high similarities between our DNA and computers. One of them is Bill Gates. Bill Gates has said that DNA is like a computer program, but far, far more advanced than any we've ever created. Now, Bill Gates, to my knowledge, is no friend of intelligent design. I'm not trying to say that he supports intelligent design, but it most definitely is the case that he's right, that DNA is very much like a computer program. And the reason is because when you look at our DNA, every three nucleotides within a gene is something called a codon, and it codes for a specific command that is then followed when that gene is being converted into a protein, when that information in the DNA that comes in a four-character code is being converted into proteins, which are built of amino acids, which is basically a 20-character code. So you're basically doing a code conversion from a four-character code to a 20-character code through this process called transcription and translation. And if you guys think back to your high school biology, you probably learned about this. This is a basic fundamental life process found in all life forms to convert the information in DNA to actually build the proteins that make up our bodies. And it's basically a code conversion process. And the key to the code is through a biochemical language. And that biochemical language functions like a computer program in that there are start commands, stop commands. There's special commands for each one of our 20 amino acids. There are other commands that tell the cell how much of each protein to produce, when to produce it, when to stop producing it. And these commands often function like if-then logic circuits. Have any of you done computer programming in here? Cool. So if what an if-then statement is, there are feedback loops, there are while loops. I mean, they're literally the very same kind of logic and Boolean type commands that you see in computer programming are found in the cell, but they function through molecules rather than through typed out characters. They literally function through molecules that are able to interact with one another and send signals to one another. And it's all functioning at the nanoscale level, and it's very, very much like a computer. And this is encoded by our DNA. So what we see in biology, really, Bill Gates is quite right that it's far more advanced than any computer program we've ever created. We are still understanding, you know, the basic DNA through transcription, translation leads to a protein. That basic central dogma of biology that you were taught in school, it's basically right, but it's kind of like saying that Newtonian physics is right when now we know that Einsteinian physics and quantum mechanics really have, shown us that Newton was right about some things, but there's a lot more to it. I mean, biology and the way that our genetic code works is astronomically complex, and we're still just learning how it works and learning to understand it. So Bill Gates is quite right, and I think that when you look at the workings of our DNA and the computer-like language that it's built upon, it just is an amazing example of intelligent design at the biomolecular level. Even Richard Dawkins recognizes the computer-like nature of our DNA. He says that the machine code of the genes is uncannily computer-like. Apart from differences in jargon, the pages of a molecular biology journal might be interchanged with those of a computer engineering journal. Again, Dawkins, no friend of intelligent design, he thinks all this evolved through random and blind and unguided processes. If that's what he wants to believe, fine. I don't have enough faith to believe that. I think that this shows that there was an intelligent cause behind it. Why? Well, in our experience, where does information, language, and code come from? It comes from intelligence. It doesn't come from random and unguided and blind chance processes. It comes from an intelligent cause. But this is not the only evidence for design that we see in our cells, because it's not just enough to have this process of information processing. You have the information in the DNA. It's converted into proteins through this computer-like system of commands and codes. But then what is the result of this process? What are the proteins that are created? Well, the result are, in many cases, micromolecular machines which outperform human design machines. So we actually see the result of this complicated process of information processing is that it produces machines. And in our experience, where do machines come from? Do they come from unguided, blind, random processes? No, they come from intelligence. They come from engineers. So this is an example of a very well-known micromolecular machine. This is called the bacterial flagellum. It's kind of become the poster child of the ID movement, but I like it because, like many cellular machines, it is built very much like a human-designed machine known as the rotary engine. Any of you car buffs, what car has a rotary engine that's popular today? Mazda, RX-7 or RX-8, right? So here you're looking at a micromolecular rotary engine. It has a rotor, it has a stator, it has a U-joint, a propeller, it has a motor, it has a bearing. It actually was just discovered recently that it has a clutch and a brake. So this is a micromolecular machine which basically functions kind of like an outboard motor on a bacterium to propel it through some kind of a liquid medium. This, I believe, is an E. coli bacterial flagellum, and our gut is filled with E. coli. They actually feed off of the food that we're digesting, and sometimes you get a bad strain that makes you sick, but E. coli is actually found naturally in our bodies, and they use these flagella in order to get around and find food. And without that, they will basically not be able to find food to eat. And this is just, you know, on a bacterium. Our bodies are filled with similar micromolecular machines that are self-assembled, self-repair, and are built through this process of information processing that I just talked to you about. What's interesting about the flagellum is that even though it's a rotary engine, it outperforms any human rotary engine ever built, at least for a car. This, I've heard, can go up to 100,000 RPMs, stop in a quarter turn and reverse direction. So it's pretty striking. What we find in biology really dwarfs what human technology can do. But, you know, the evolutionists would say this is the result of unguided, blind processes, not intelligent design. I think that there's a very strong positive argument for intelligent design to be made here. Another example of design comes not from the level of biology, but from the level of physics and cosmology. This is from what's called the fine-tuning of the physical laws and constants of the universe to allow for advanced life. Let me give you an example of how this works. Let's say that you had a machine in your basement that could create universes, okay? It's a little machine. You didn't tell your mom about it. You bought it off of the home shopping network. You set it up in your basement. And every Saturday afternoon, you go down there and you create universes, okay? And the way this machine works is it has all these dials. These dials can be tuned to any setting you need to control the fundamental laws and constants of your universe. Some of those include things like the mass density of the universe, the expansion rate of your universe, the ratio of electrons to protons in your universe, the electromagnetic constant, the gravitational constant, the strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force, all these basic fundamental physical constants and laws that are in our universe, you're able to control them through these dials on your universe. What you find through your experiments is that each of these dials has to be set to a very narrow range in order to create a universe that is even friendly to housing life. So if you don't have each of these dials set to a very narrow range on the dial meter, you will not be able to have any life inside your universe. So this is very significant. What this shows is that we have complex and specified information built into the laws and constants of our universe. We call this cosmic fine-tuning, like you're fine-tuning these dials on this machine, but it's really the same kind of complex and specified information. We have a very, very unlikely set of parameters, i.e. the physical laws and constants of the universe, that are specified to what is necessary for life. And just to give you guys an idea of how finely tuned the physical laws and constants are for the universe, let's just take one of these, the expansion rate of the universe. Now, if you've heard this before, you've heard things like, oh, the fine-tuning of the universe is fine-tuned to within one part in 10 to the 500th power. I mean, that's pretty small. We don't even usually think about, you know, numbers that small. Well, it was discovered just a few years ago that the expansion rate of the universe, basically the rate at which the universe is expanding, has to be very finely tuned, or else if it expands too quickly, then all the matter will get spread out, and you will never be able to clump together through gravity to form things like stars or planets, basically the kind of homes that life requires. But if it expands too slowly, the mass of the universe will actually pull it back in on itself, and it will collapse, and it will not keep expanding, so you won't have a universe that's able to house life again. So you have a very finely tuned expansion rate of the universe. According to some discoveries in the last 5 or 10 years, the expansion rate of the universe is fine-tuned to within one part in 10 raised to the power of 10 to the 123rd power, okay? I mean, we're used to dealing with really small numbers. We don't even have names for those numbers. I mean, I could not write that number out if I tried. These are astronomically small numbers. It just shows you the depth to which our universe is finely tuned to allow for advanced life. I think this shows that the universe was intelligently designed with life in mind. That's what I infer from this. And a number of scientists actually have recognized this. You probably have heard how controversial intelligent design is in biology. Well, it turns out that in physics and cosmology, design is actually a lot less controversial. I'm not saying that every physicist believes that the universe was intelligently designed, but it's less controversial than it is in biology. This is actually a quote from an atheist cosmologist named Fred Hoyle, who said that a common sense interpretation of the data suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics as well as with chemistry and biology. So, very interesting quote. Let me give you one more example of design going back to biology here. I said earlier that the vast majority of our genetic code is performing important functions in our cell. Well, how many of you guys ever heard of the concept of junk DNA, or the term junk DNA? You may even hear people say only 3% of our DNA codes for a gene, and really the rest is just useless evolutionary garbage. It's genetic junk that is just the result of millions of years of random mutations scrambling our DNA, producing genetic junk, and it's proof, evidence, and documentation that evolution, a process of random mutation and natural selection, produced our genome because it's full of useless garbage that no designer would produce. Well, they certainly say this. Darwinism says that the unguided, random, and clumsy processes of evolution result in useless parts like excess garbage or junk DNA. And junk DNA, again, is DNA sequences that are thought to be functionless because they do not code for a protein. There's one major problem with this argument, and that is that for decades, it assumed that because we did not understand what this DNA did, that therefore it was junk. And now that we're studying it, it turns out that they were wrong. This DNA is not junk. It is not junk DNA. Junk DNA is now a falsified idea. The vast majority we have discovered, the vast majority of our DNA is performing vital cellular functions. And this is actually an example where evolutionary thinking held back the progress of science because they assumed that if they did not understand what type of DNA did, that therefore it was genetic junk DNA that did nothing. This is a testable prediction of intelligent design, that the cell will tend to contain less functionless junk and biology will not tend to contain functionless parts. And just to show you guys how this evolutionary mindset of junk DNA has played out, this is from the journal Science a few years ago. It said the term junk DNA for many years repelled mainstream researchers from studying non-coding DNA. Who except for a small number of genomic clochards would like to dig through genomic garbage? However, in science, as in normal life, there are some clochards who, at the risk of being ridiculed, explore unpopular territories. Now more and more biologists regard repetitive elements as genomic treasure. What's he saying? Evolutionary thinking actually held back the progress of science. It prevented people from studying function for junk DNA because it caused them to just assume that this DNA was junk. Now, the reality is that it's not junk. And this is actually a quote from a pro-ID evolutionary biologist named Richard Sternberg. He says that the selfish junk DNA narrative and other allied frameworks must join the other icons of neo-Darwinian evolutionary theory that, despite their variance with empirical evidence, nevertheless persist in the literature. So it's very clear now from our understanding of DNA that it's not junk, that it has function. Another good example of where evolution has resulted in bad junk-type thinking is with regards to this organ right here, the appendix. The appendix, people have thought for many years, because of evolutionary assumptions, that it's just a vestigial organ, that our evolutionary ancestors used it, and we don't use it anymore. And biology textbooks for decades have been teaching students that it's just evidence that we are actually descended from quadrupeds, from four-legged animals that ate a lot of diet with a lot of roughage, and that we don't need the appendix anymore because we walk upright, we have a different diet, blah, blah, blah. You know, this is the argument that they made. This is the evidence that we're descended from four-legged ancestors. Well, here's actually a news article. I got this off of yahoo.com just a couple weeks ago. It said, the body's appendix has long been thought of as nothing more than a worthless evolutionary artifact, good for nothing save a potentially lethal case of inflammation. Now researchers suggest the appendix is a lot more than a useless remnant. In a way, the idea that the appendix is an organ whose time has passed has itself become a concept whose time is over. Maybe it's time to correct the textbooks, said researcher William Parker. Many biology texts still today refer to the appendix as a vestigial organ. We now know that it provides very important functions. It provides certain immunofunctions, such as housing toxins. And it also, if you ever have taken antibiotics and it kills off the good bacteria, and then you have to take probiotics in order to replace them, it actually seems like the appendix might house some good bacteria that can then be released into your gut when you need it if you don't have enough good bacteria. So it actually is performing very important functions. Just because you can live without it doesn't mean that it doesn't have a function and that it's just a useless vestigial organ. So again, that's a good example of how evolutionary thinking led science down the wrong path. So what is the very basic basis of intelligent design? The discovery of biochemical language and irreducibly complex molecular machines, the discovery of digital information and information processing systems in the cell, the discovery of fine-tuning of the laws and constants of physics, and then most importantly, our inference to design is based upon our cause and effect understanding of how the world works, understanding of the relationship between intelligence and information, that when you see certain types of complex and specified information, that requires an intelligent cause in our experience. And that's why we infer intelligence from all of these examples of complex and specified information in biology. So you can disagree with the conclusions of ID, and that's fine. I think this is an issue where reasonable people can disagree. But one cannot reasonably claim that this argument is based upon religion, faith, or divine revelation. My argument today has been based strictly upon science, and I'm using the scientific method to make this argument. So I don't mind if you disagree with ID, but don't claim that I'm making a faith-based argument or an argument based upon religion or divine revelation, because that's not what I'm doing. This is a scientific argument.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2008. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.